Welcome to Eye on the Valley with Surjeet and Ali. This is the very first week of our show here on CIVL, and we are excited to present to you a bi-weekly program on local news here in the Fraser Valley, funded by the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Ali Laube, a multimedia journalist with 6 years of experience. I was the editor-in-chief at Kwantlen Polytechnic University's newspaper, The Runner, for 4 years. Now, I'm an intern at the TAI, the communications coordinator for a downtown East Side resource distribution network called Everybody's In, and I'm the host of this show. I'm also a mixed-race pansexual woman who is focused primarily on covering criminal and social justice, which I will be bringing to this show. Surjeet Atwal is my co-host. He worked in Liberal MLA Daryl Plekis' constituency office as a community outreach coordinator. Recently, he decided to distance himself from politics and to pursue journalism. He lived in Surrey for most of his life and is part of the vibrant Sikh community that exists both there and here in Abbotsford. Using Surjeet's connections with local government and my experience as a journalist, we invite high-profile guests to speak about local issues, and at the end of each episode discuss our interview with an analyst from the Valley. This week, we're talking to a former cabinet minister of the Legislative Assembly of British Columbia, Mike DeYoung, followed by a critical discussion between myself, Surjeet, and UFV political science professor, Ron Dart. But first, here are the top Canadian Journalism Initiative headlines of the week. From CFRO 100.5, Vancouver Co-op Radio, Tan May Z reports, supportive housing often doesn't work, says Tent City Advocate. For many, the joint announcement made by the city and the province last week of 450 new homes for the unhoused population sounded like good news. But for Tent City Advocate and sociology instructor Nicole Luongo, the announcement filled her with dread. Luongo said, "We have seen this happen multiple times over the years. The new supportive housing gets announced, and many people feel that it's unlivable for a variety of reasons. Members of the general public assume that supportive housing is a solution for unhoused residents," she said. Quote, "And when invariably it doesn't work for some people, that gives the general public more ammunition, if you will, to point the finger at unhoused people," end quote. Luongo noted that to apply for supportive housing from BC Housing, applicants have to meet competency requirements regarding their communication skills. While such a requirement might sound benign, Luongo told The Pulse that a social worker with a master's degree may have different ideas of communication skills from a former sex worker, for example. Also reported by CRFO 100.5, Vancouver Co-op Radio, this time by David P. Ball, former judge speaks out on investigation into anti-Indigenous healthcare racism. Former provincial judge Mary Ellen Turple-Lafon's investigation into racism allegations against British Columbia's healthcare system is asking more Indigenous people to consider telling their stories. And in an interview with The Pulse on CFRO, the ex-children's watchdog for the government says she already has more than 400 reports filed to her office. She was tasked last month with looking into reports that emergency room staff were playing betting games on the blood alcohol content of Indigenous patients. That allegation sparked the province's health minister, Adrian Dix, to appoint Turple-Lafon to look into anti-Indigenous racism more broadly. Quote, "My prime focus has been on making sure I hear from Indigenous peoples and Indigenous peoples who may be really intimidated to share their story because maybe they don't feel comfortable," she told The Pulse on July 21st. Quote, "So myself as an Indigenous person who has had a lot of experience doing these investigations, I can give safety. I'm at an arm's length from the government." Turple-Lafon is of Cree ancestry and was a provincial court judge in Saskatchewan before taking on the role of BC's independent children's watchdog in 2006, where she served, frequently, with scathing criticisms of government, for 10 years. Health Minister Adrian Dix called the unconfirmed allegations of the alcohol level betting game, quote, completely unacceptable, end quote, and vowed to make changes required to the system. If true, it is intolerable, unacceptable, and racist, Dix said on June 22, when he appointed Turple LaFont. He said she has the power to access health agencies and to, quote, make recommendations about immediate and long-term next steps. And finally, from CKTZ 89.5, Cortez Community Radio on Cortez Island by Roy Hales. Election 2020 issues, tent cities. The BC Liberals are calling for an immediate end to tent cities that have sprung up in Campbell River, as well as larger cities like Vancouver and Victoria. In a press release, Roxanne Helm, the BC Liberal candidate for Oak Bay Gordonhead, said, quote, this is a matter of public safety. Each unsupervised 24/7 tent encampment is an extremely dangerous place to be. We know people are smoking drugs in nylon tents, criminal elements have infiltrated the camps to prey on the vulnerable people within them, and so on and so on. This is not to mention that the 24/7 tent encampments are preventing the use of our parks as they were intended, she said. Aside from the suggestion that they must be appropriately housed, she did not explain where people in these camps should go. This is an ongoing issue that will be unfolding throughout the election. To read more about these stories, visit canada-info.ca. Now we're heading into our interview with Mike DeYoung, a BC politician sometimes described as the minister of everything for how many roles he has occupied in the provincial government. To give you some examples, he has served as Minister of Health, Labor, and Citizen Services, Forests, Public Safety, Aboriginal Relations and Reconciliation, and Minister of Finance. Up until recently, DeYoung was the Cabinet Minister of the Legislative Assembly, and he has been with the Liberals since day one. He was re-elected as an MLA 6 times in Abbotsford in 1996, 2001, 2005, 2009, 2013, and 2017, and was the House Leader of the Official Opposition with the BC Liberals between 1994 and 2001. He lost the 2011 BC Liberal leadership race to Christy Clark, and is widely regarded as a vocal politician. He's also faced several controversies over the years. As opposition critic, he was ejected from the Legislative Assembly for calling the then Attorney General Colin Gableman a, quote, liar, and was later sued for libel by Federal Cabinet Minister Herb Dhaliwal. As Minister of Forests, he faced criticism for privatizing 70,000 hectares of Crown land despite resistance from ministry staff, the Hupaskath First Nations, and the Tsihat First Nation. As Attorney General, he approved a payment of $6 million in legal fees for the Liberal Party whistleblowers, who didn't have enough money to cover the legal fees themselves, he said. Now, he is rerunning as an MLA for Abbotsford West, despite being frustrated with the NDP's decision to call a snap election. He spoke to us in September about the leading party's response to the election, reflections on his political career, and the issues he thinks need to be addressed for Abbotsford voters. Here's our conversation.
Thank you for joining us, Mr. Mike DeYoung.
Sarjeet, always great to be on the program with you.
All right, my first question is, when you were MLA for Abbotsford, what were the key issues you focused on addressing, and how have they been addressed?
Well, of course, I've been the MLA for some time, and going back all those years when I entered provincial politics for the first time and sought a seat in the legislature, it was because we had been lacking in the kind of infrastructure investments that a community our size required. Back in the 1990s, the government of the day, it was an NDP government, had been promising a new hospital for over a decade, and it never got done. So I made that a priority back then when I ran for the first time. And happily, when we became government in 2001, we were able to move that very quickly and see construction begin quickly and get a new hospital, a much needed hospital in Abbotsford. Similarly, with our community growing the way it has and continues to grow, transportation infrastructure. In those days, people may not remember, but the interchanges at McCallum Road, at Clearbrook Road, and Mount Lehman Road in particular were terrible. They had been built in the 1960s for a different volume of traffic, a different sized community. And we made improvements to all of those, and improvements, the Abbotsford Mission Highway, and more recently to the airport along Mount Lehman Road. So those are things that were important to the economic life of the community, health and welfare, the hospital, obviously, but the trail network we now have in Abbotsford, second to none anywhere in Canada, were all things that I have focused on over the years as MLA.
How are ways you wish you had been more impactful than you were in Abbotsford as an MLA?
There are areas that I think there is more work to be done. Seniors care would be at the top of that list. We are an aging population, and ensuring that we have places with the proper supports in place for our seniors population, I think is going to be a challenge, a continuing challenge going forward, and an area that I intend to focus on.
Thank you. Drivers in the Fraser Valley want lower ICBC rates and higher rebates. How have you responded to that?
Well, of course, for the last three and a half years, I and my colleagues in the BC Liberal Party have been in the opposition. And during that time, we've seen rates continuously increase. We've heard a lot of excuses from Mr. Horgan and Mr. Eby and the NDP, and a lot of finger pointing. The fact is, we managed to keep rates far lower than they are today. And we are seeing those rates continue to climb to levels that are really unreasonable. It's getting worse, not better. And that seems to be, in many areas, the mantra of the present government. For all their talk, they seem to have made it worse, not better, for drivers in British Columbia. Less choices, and insurance premiums that are skyrocketing at a time when families simply can't afford it.
And a little follow-up on that, Mike. The NDP would say to you that you guys were in charge for about 10 years and you left the ICBC file in a minute. What would your response be?
We governed for just over 16 years, and I think any reasonable person will tell you that when the transition in government occurred, the NDP inherited the strongest balance sheet in the country. Mm-hmm. And that includes ICBC. And as the finance minister for the last 5 years of that time, there's a reason we have the only AAA credit rating in the country. That's not me talking. That's independent third party. The NDP inherited that.
How do you feel about public pressure for the Liberals to reconsider viable, affordable public transit alternatives in the Fraser Valley, including the Alstom hydrogen train project by rail for the valley?
Well, the need to consider different ways and transit-related ways to move people through the Fraser Valley corridor, I think, is very clear. And it's one of the reasons that when we were government, which we have not been for the last 3.5 years, we took steps to expand the SkyTrain network. You know, people plans to move SkyTrain as far east as Langley, and I have ideas about how a transit link can be extended beyond Langley into places like Abbotsford and Chilliwack. People also forget that the Portman Bridge, in many ways, very significant ways, was also a transit project, because for the first time with dedicated bus lanes, transit lanes, transit buses could run across the Fraser River, which they couldn't do for over a decade. The NDP was opposed to that project. They don't like people to know that now, but the Portman Bridge was also a transit project. The only thing, Sarjeet, that I ask people to consider when they are advancing ideas around light rail or rail-related traffic, which I think are very important to examine and move forward on, is the fact that for those projects to be affordable, because they are very, very expensive, in the billions of dollars, we will also need to densify housing along the route, and certainly at the stations, at the transit stations. So as people bring forward their ideas, what I do ask them to show me is where the densification, the housing densification, because we can solve two problems here. We can solve the problem of moving people, but we can also solve the challenge around available housing if we do this a smart way. And I think there is a smart way to do this. And I actually see the YXX, the Abbotsford Airport, as a logical Central Valley hub. Obviously, we have to look at that in detail. It's, as I say, not cheap, but you know, the Fraser Highway corridor strikes me as a logical place to increase housing density and create a tie-in between housing and transit that connects into the SkyTrain network. I don't think you bring SkyTrain all the way into Abbotsford; it's too expensive. Okay. But some form of light surface rail down that corridor that connects into YXX, and then provides a means for people from Surrey and Langley and elsewhere to utilize the Abbotsford Airport when we're back to the kind of air travel that I hope we get back to soon would be good.
Okay, thank you. Based on your experience in Abbotsford, what do you predict are some of the key challenges facing people living in the city due to the pandemic?
Well, recovery. A firm plan for economic recovery. We've seen government programs that involve providing short-term support. The federal government has provided most of that support, but those programs are coming to an end. And what we need more than ever now is a strategy, a broad province-wide economic strategy for restarting our economy and ensuring that people have the jobs and opportunities that they require going forward.
What are the top 3 to 5 issues that are important to British Columbians in the upcoming election?
Health and safety will continue to top that list, and then economic well-being and economic recovery.
COVID-19 isn't the only crisis affecting Canadians right now. Overdose deaths reached a record high this summer. What do you wish you had been able to accomplish during your time as health minister that could have helped reduce the impact of this drug poisoning crisis today?
Steps have been taken around what's called harm reduction and providing a safer supply of drugs. Okay. In some instances, that may be appropriate. But there are other agencies who are prepared to treat people on what is called an abstinence-based program, about helping people stop, get off the addiction, and stop the use of these harmful drugs. And yet those agencies, many of them nonprofit organizations, very well trained, very well motivated, and they don't receive the same funding. In fact, in many instances, they don't receive any public funding because of restrictions that have been put in place. I think there are clearly circumstances in which harm reduction makes sense. But what I don't agree with is the proposition that there is no place for abstinence-based programs. I think in some circumstances there is a place, and there shouldn't be a bias against either one of those.
Many British Columbians are struggling financially due to COVID-19. How could the province better support small businesses?
Small businesses live or die by virtue of the strength of the economy and the ability people have to patronize those small businesses, incenting investments, incenting activities, economic activities, ultimately are what will make the difference. So finding ways to provide tax relief, finding ways to incent homeowners to make investments in their home and renovation projects. And these are all things that will create opportunities for small businesses and generate the kind of economic activity that they will need to survive.
Thank you, Mike. Good. Thank you so much and good luck.
Thanks, Sarjeet. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Eye on the Valley with Sarjeet and Ali. I'm Ali Laube, and you just heard our conversation with Mike DeYoung, who's rerunning for election as Liberal MLA for Abbotsford West. In every episode following our politician interviews, Sarjeet and I talked to local analyst, academic, or expert to review the interview and provide their insight. This week, we interviewed Ron Dart, a political science instructor at the University of the Fraser Valley. Ron was on staff with Amnesty International before he joined UFE in 1990. He specializes in Canadian politics, journalism, and literature, as well as international relations, human rights, and religions. Here's what he had to say about our interview with DeYoung.
Thank you for joining us, sir.
Oh, no problem.
My first question is, how do you think calling an early election will affect the cooperation amongst the parties for COVID pandemic relief legislation?
Well, I think it's a difficult question because on the one hand, I think certainly the last few years, the NDP has felt somewhat hobbled by having to work with the Greens. And there are certain bills they'd like to pass, directions they'd like to take that they haven't been able. And the former head of the Greens was never the easiest person to work with temperamentally. And so I think the NDP are torn, I think, as any party would be at the present time, between with ratings a little higher, because they have handled the COVID thing as best as they can, I think. And most people have appreciated that they've been imperfect in doing it, yet nonetheless, they've done a relatively good job. They want to, obviously, with the ratings a little higher, move forward with a majority government. Obviously, the Liberals are going to argue that this is an inappropriate time to call election, given the COVID crisis. The NDP will argue, yes, it's not the best time, but we've been somewhat tripped up by having to work as a majority government to get through things that we couldn't get through the way we wanted. So a lot of it depends on the seeing eye, doesn't it?
Yes. My second question is, in your opinion, was it an informed decision in Mike's part to critique the NDP?
Mike, rightly so, has critiqued the NDP in its time in office, and certain of his criticisms, I think, are valid within a limited way, because the NDP in the last year, well, there's been two difficulties it's had to grapple with. One, minority government, and they've constantly had to negotiate the best they can with the Greens. And then in the last year, of course, the accelerated COVID, which has very much handcuffed any sort of a direction forward economically in other areas. So it's been a difficult phase for the NDP, as any minority government. And then you throw COVID in, it just complicates an already complicated problem for the NDP. And of course, it's the role of the Liberals in that sense to look at all the faults and failures. But if the Liberals were in power, certainly the NDP would point out all their gaffes and faux pas as well. That's just the nature of the sport.
I have a lot of follow-ups for you, actually. As somebody with a history of studying political science, what do you think personally of the decision for the NDP to call an election right now?
It looks like the opportunity is good to have a majority government. So ratings high, majority government, they'd be able to move forward without being tripped up by another potential party. Now, whether this occurs, I guess we have to wait and see. But I would see this from the NDP at this point, the stars are lined up for them in moving forward. And now the percentage of people who come out to vote, or whether it's sort of a voter fatigue because of COVID, that will be up to citizens to decide.
Sure, I guess we'll see the results of that after the votes are cast.
Yes, yeah.
I do quickly want to ask you about your experience with living in the Valley. Have you been in the Valley for your whole life?
No, I grew up in Toronto. Moved out here. I was on staff with Amnesty International. I was the regional director in the 1980s. Moved out here with family late 1980s. So I've been here since 1989, and I started working at what was then Fraser Valley College in the political science department in 1990.
That's why I want to ask you about voter priorities in the Valley. I imagine it's something that you're quite familiar with, but for people who aren't living in the Fraser Valley, how would you describe what you anticipate voter priorities will be in this upcoming election?
Well, I would think the central upper Fraser Valley has consistently voted on the political right federally, which was historically the progressive conservative, but when it split under the Reform Alliance that then Harper brought into being, they tend to vote right of center. And provincially, of course, the right of center party is the Liberals in the Fraser Valley. So the particular demos, or the people, or the constellation in the Valley tends to be dominated by either a soft right of center or a strong right of center, very business driven, lighter state, lighter taxes, as little government intervention as possible. Liberty and freedom is prioritized. And so you pretty well can predict the results in the central upper Fraser Valley that it will be a liberal sweep. That's pretty consistent.
Because of mail-in votes this year, and the confusion of ordering the mail-in votes, you think the turnout could be lower, and could that help one party over the other?
Yeah, anytime you have a new system voting pattern that is quite different than going personally and voting, some people can become confused by it or not put the work into it, and so they just don't vote in comparison to just turning up at a literal poll and do voting. And so that could have an impact, in terms of potential difference. But you'll tend to find most people in the central Fraser Valley are very political, but political on the right. And so whether it's walk-in polls or mail-in or a variety of options, they really take their public responsibility, their civic responsibility seriously. How they translate that into right of center politics is, of course, what defines the central upper Fraser Valley.
Ron, could you explain what you mean when you say center right? How does that manifest in the Valley?
Well, at a political level, the way it manifests itself, and then there's the issues which, of course, underlie that political level. But at a political level, it's a consistent vote for the Conservative Party federally in this area. I mean, there's a fringe Heritage Party, Christian Heritage Party, but they won't go anywhere. But there is that very small percentage, just as like there's a small percentage of Greens on the left, just as on the Heritage on the right. So federally, with, as I mentioned earlier, the dissolution of the Progressive Conservative Party and the swing further to the right than the Progressive Conservatives ever were, following an Albertan tradition of the Ernest Manning, Preston Manning, Stockwell Day, and then Stephen Harper, who moved from Ontario to Alberta, and the whole Calgary School of Political Science. At a federal level, it's always right of center. And when that gets translated into economic issues, and there's social issues there as well, there's ecological issues there. I mean, there's 10 or 12 issues which are hot button issues in the culture wars. But at a federal level, it will always swing conservative. At a provincial level, it will swing liberal, because liberals are just the provincial version of the federal conservatives in that sense.
Right. That makes sense. I do want to, again, bring it quickly back to this interview with Mike before we finish up here, because he talked in the interview about public desire for more public transit infrastructure in the Valley. What do you think is the feasibility of this actually happening? Because it has been in talks for a very long time.
Yes, there's a long history. I mean, there's actually not only a long history, there actually was transportation out here at one point. So there are some people who are arguing that why can't we return to what once was? And I think Mike mentioned is if you want to go forward with alternate transportation, how do you increase population density in an area? So the two work together, because it's one thing to have transportation coming out here regardless of the means, but if you have light population, it gets to be very expensive to be doing that. Whereas if you have high population density, then there's the money to pay for the infrastructure, to pay for people going back and forth. And so it's a balance. It's a difficult one. And I would think Liberals, NDP, and Greens would, if possible, want to move forward in that. But then there's the economic element as well that has to be factored in. How much debt does a government go in to do that? And how much higher do you have to raise the taxes to afford something like that? And when you get a political constituency that wants lighter taxes, lighter government, and yet you want a transportation infrastructure which is going to cost more, hence greater state involvement, greater taxes, most will vote for the same as status quo, regardless of its impact on global warming and pollution.
Mm. Yeah, something that I've noticed, a lot of people who seem to support the idea of more infrastructure in rural parts of the Valley are people who actually work in different cities, or live in different cities and have to commute to these places for work. So potentially the people who are really supporting it aren't even in the correct riding to be able to influence these projects, at least on a municipal level. Is that accurate to say that that's a barrier?
Yeah, because you tend to, those many who are for it, as you say, have moved out from the city because it's much cheaper to live out here than in Vancouver. The problem is many of the, I mean, they're growing out here, you know, Abbotsford, Chilliwack, Agassiz, Yarrow, and many of these places are growing, but it's going to take another generation or so to have enough people to legitimate a high expenditure from the government to build alternate transportation. I mean, they've done the one obviously out to Mission, but the bulk of the population, the Valley, lives on the other side of the river, not Mission. And so the Abbotsford, Chilliwack, Hope, you know, Yellow Brick Road, as it were, is the sort of the position that many people here would want this alternate form of transportation, because that's where the bulk of the population lives, not across the river. Because on the one hand, you have environmental issues. You want to look at forms of energy that are not polluting. On the other hand, any government has to look at what's the cost of that and who's going to be paying. And if you have a right of center constituency, they don't want to be paying higher taxes, and they're willing to subordinate ecology for economics. If you're a little more left of center, you're trying to live the balance, in a little more delicate and difficult way, and saying, listen, if you just think long term, there's going to be disaster. Or if you just think short term, there's going to be disaster long term. And so a lot of it depends on politicians. Are they just thinking they're short term in office, but not thinking long term? And environment is obviously one of those top five issues we face. How is the best way to go about that, given the accelerated growth in the Central Upper Valley? And so obviously Mike de Jong is going to go one direction on that. The Greens and the NDP will go another. But because we tend to lean right here, the tendency is to think short-term profit, but not long-term sustainability.
Because the NDP has seats in Surrey and stuff? They said there's things that the Liberal Party says that NDP doesn't care about the Fraser Valley because they don't get the three ridings here. They're going to care more, develop more in Surrey and those kind of things. Do you think politics plays a role in what the NDP develops in the Fraser Valley when they're in government?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's always in politics the idealism of what a party stands for, then given the fact they have limited time, energy, and finances, where they're going to focus it. And if you think you're going to get more votes in a certain area that's going to give you a majority in Victoria, and you assist in building projects in those areas, you're likely to get more votes, then why would you focus on the Central Upper Fraser Valley when you're consistently defeated? And then in other ridings where you know you have a better chance of winning.
I want to talk about ICBC. So ICBC was brought up during our interview with Mike. We talked about basically who's to blame for the ICBC mess. Now, as a political science instructor, what's your opinion on that?
Yes.
Well, first of all, you're always going to get one party blame another for a mess. So that's a given. And of course, Mike will inevitably do that. And he's going to argue the case that under the Liberal regime, of which he played a very, very important role, there was a balanced budget and credit ratings were at a very high level. And so they should have their backs padded and have little medals on their chest for what they accomplished. And he's right. He's right in saying that the Liberal Party, to some degree, played a very important role in dealing with ICBC, and given its historic problems, because it has had historic problems, and nobody's going to deny that. I think perhaps he was a little skewed and excessively blaming ICBC in terms of what he sees is its contemporary malaise. There are many factors at work in ICBC's malaise other than just blaming a political party. I think if you wanted an honest assessment of the two parties in ICBC, you'd have to sit down and do a hard, chestnut cracking of the facts and figures and how the NDP read what was done in ICB under the Liberals beyond Mike's glowing report. And then you'd have to get NDP talking back to Liberals and say, well, perhaps you're cherry picking with the facts here and what we've been trying to do and what we've accomplished. And if we had gaffes, yeah, we have, but so did you when you were in power. So let's not go whistleblowing in terms of your own virtues and our excessive vices. And so I think an honest discussion on ICBC would be to bring two members of both parties together and get both to discuss both the positive they had contributed to ICBC, but also equally their gaffes, their inadequacies. And so that way you would move forward. But when people have both cannons loaded and constantly shoot at one another, you'd only go so far in meaningful public discourses.
Yeah, I mean, you raised some very good points. And Mike was notably emotional in that interview. I found quite strikingly vehement about his critiques of the NDP. It seems like there's a lot of emotions in the air right now regarding this election.
Well, there isn't any election. And as I mentioned earlier, for some, politics is an analogy to a sports game. And when you're in the Stanley Cup or when you're in the Grey Cup, emotions are high, they're intense, and there's two teams. Yeah. And the danger always is in politics, I mean, we can just follow what's happening across the border. Yeah, idealize your own view, you demonize someone else, and that just, it minimizes the importance of public life. And so, of course, Mike is going to be intense and emotional, but so will people be in the NDP and the Greens. And so, as they should be, these are important issues. I mean, not to be engaged emotionally is to be less than human, but to be engaged emotionally, in which facts are lined up in a certain direction and others are ignored, that's not healthy for the common good of a province or for a country or for global economy either. And that's sometimes the downside of partisan politics, is we select information that suits our ideology, and what doesn't fit into that Procrustean bed, we simply ignore those facts. And that's why you need good people from both parties to come together to have a much more mature discussion, in this case, obviously, ICBC.
Yeah, and if I may just end up by saying this, I think even though they're partisan at this moment, but when it came to the COVID crisis, for say, they put their ideology aside and work together. So that's a positive sign.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, because when you have a crisis and a tyranny of an urgent issue, the best women and men in all parties will bracket their ideological clashes, their caricaturing, and say, we're here to serve the people. Now, something like COVID is serious. And so how do these people from different parties come together momentarily for the common weal or the common good of people in this province? And to many, Mike and many in the Liberal Party, the Greens, they've had their ongoing criticisms of way it could be handled differently. But generally, they've been quite willing to say, you know, how the NDP and Dr. Bonnie Henry and others have worked on this. Something like COVID, you come together to support one another. And so, but when these intense moments pass, that's when, of course, the secondary issues, which move away from the primary issues, take over and you get partisan politics again.
Thank you for doing this, sir.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Eye on the Valley with Sarjeet and Ali. That concludes the discussion portion of our show today, and now we are going to provide a community spotlight. Every week during the community spotlight segment, we're going to tell you a little bit about a group in the Valley who is doing some really great work. We might even expand that over to the island or to the Metro Vancouver area from time to time, but this time we are focusing on Abbotsford. Archway Community Services is a great organization that is helping the homeless in the Valley. The Homelessness Prevention Program is an initiative aimed at providing individuals and identified at-risk groups facing homelessness with portable rent supplements and support services to help them access rental housing in the private, non-subsidized housing market. If you're eligible and approved, the rent supplement can assist with your rent, damage deposit, and costs that help you secure housing. For example, getting identification. To learn more and see if you're eligible, visit archway.ca. Thank you for listening to Eye on the Valley with Sarjeet and Ali here on CIVL 101.7. We'll be posting these 45-minute episodes twice per week, once on Mondays and once on Thursdays. To keep up with us, visit civl.ca or canada-info.ca.